Good morning, everybody. I am Geeta Misra, and I'm the president of AVID and the executive director of CREA, and it's my honorable pleasure to welcome all of you to the 11th AVID Forum in Cape Town, the power of movements. I want to take a moment and pay tribute to someone whose extraordinary leadership and extraordinary voice has contributed a lot to our movements, Miriam Makeba, or who was popularly called Mama Africa. I want to start with a word that was born in South Africa, where we are gathered today to talk about the power of movements. A word that captures both the sting of injustice and the power of movements. Social movements in overcoming oppression, discrimination, and injustice. A word that evokes one of the most monumental struggles in the world against apartheid, or the system of racial segregation that was in place in South Africa for almost 50 years. The word I want to open this AVID plenary with is Amandla, a Xhosa and Zulu word that means power. And when accompanied with Awetu, Amandla Awetu means power to us or power to the people. These are words that have the power to shift power. Like other words that come to mind, Azadi, or the Hindi word for freedom, is another such word. It was the rallying cry for India's struggle for independence from the British, and is now part of the lexicon of the Indian women's movement where I come from. Of course, words do not bring about social change by themselves. But as British playwright Tom Stoppard once said, words are sacred. If you get the right ones in the right order, you can nudge the world a little. I'd like to evoke the power of movements that have nudged the word a little through words. Some of the popular slogans, we associate them, I'd like to share with you. These slogans are not just words. They represent the claims of people fighting for social justice on various forms. That's from the labor movement, the granddaddy of social movements, the peace movement, from the early consciousness-raising days, from the Vienna Conference, and the women's movement, of course, the Stop Violence Against Women movement, the reproductive rights movement, the sexuality rights movement in the time of HIV, the human rights movement, the struggle against HIV, the LGBT rights movement, the sex workers movement, the Barack Obama campaign in 2008, and that's the popular World Social Forum slogan as part of the larger movement against corporate global capital. All these slogans tell us social movements are rooted in fighting a diversity of oppressions and injustices. Many movements emerged out of the liberation struggles for independence in the countries of the global south. But what are called the new social movements can be local, national, regional, or transnational. They can spark off anywhere. They can be seeded anywhere, on the streets, in shanty towns like the South Africa Shack Dwellers Movement, in university coffee houses like the student movement against the Vietnam War, in workplaces like the Solidarity Movement in Poland, in areas where people are being displaced by so-called development projects like the Narmada Dam in India, or on the internet through sites like MoveOn.org, which channeled global resistance and outrage against the war in Iraq. They can take place where there is democracy, in situations of occupation like Palestine, and in countries where we assume there is no space to create a struggle. Women in Iran, for instance, started building a movement in the early 1980s when Khomeini's regime had dismantled nearly all the rights that women had secured between 1900 and 1979. All they had left was the right to vote. But even in this small crack, they organize themselves. Disabled movement, disabled women in New Zealand and India have organized to make sign language an official language in those countries. In the public imagination, social movements are often associated with simple acts of resistance. Women hugging trees in northern India instead of allowing them to be cut as part of the environmental Chipko movement. A black woman, Rosa Parks, traveling in the whites-only section of a bus as part of the American civil rights struggles. Students going on hunger strikes in China to protest the murder of a sympathetic general secretary. Anti-nuclear activists mounting vigil at radioactive sites like Chernobyl. Protesters against HIV chaining themselves to fences so that they can't be dragged away, etc. While these acts of resistance become the public face, the movements they are part of run much deeper. In this sense, movements are like icebergs. A bit of it visible on top, the rest of it held together as an invisible mass. There are many ways to think about, understand, and conceptualize social movements. As a major vehicle for ordinary people's participation in public politics, as a process by which ordinary people make collective claims on others, as politics by other means, often the only means open to relatively powerless groups. When the African-American author Alice Walker says, "I have a rage in me to defy the stars," she is talking the language and concepts of social movements. But a rage and refusal are not enough. The heart is not enough. The head must be allied to this. This is the second thing that all movements have, a political analysis of oppression. When a Dalit or low-caste woman says she can't love someone outside her own caste, not because of purity issues, but because she is not free to make her own sexual choices, she understands her political condition. When a lesbian woman says she can't introduce her lover to her mother because of the stranglehold of heteronormativity, she understands her political condition. The good thing about political conditions are that they can change. All social movements are about overcoming asymmetries of power, about shifting power from the powerful to the powerless, whether we see the power axis in terms of class, gender, race, caste, sexuality, religion, ability, or what have you. But when social movements aim to shift power, they do so with the goal of equity in mind. The aim of making women powerful is not to make men powerless, but to ensure that women also have power, the power to make our own decisions, the power to ensure that political, social, and economic resources and opportunities flow to us, the power to set agendas. But it is not enough for us to shift power outside of our movements. We need to ensure that power is shared within our movements today, that our movements do not become monoliths presiding over hierarchies of oppression. Whose struggles do our movements represent? Do they represent all our collective struggles or those of the more powerful amongst us? Do our movements include those at the margins? Lesbian women, sex workers, indigenous women, young women, Muslim women, Roma women, disabled women, etc. Which brings me to the last two things that all movements share: a belief in the power of many, not one; a belief in we, not just I. With a single act of while a single act of resistance can spark a movement, it is not itself a movement. Movements are about collective claims. But whose collective claims are we talking about? Whose people's movements? Can we think of a women's movement without women? A labor movement without workers? A youth movement without young people? An LGBT movement without lesbian, gay, transgendered women? A student movement without students? A Dalit movement without Dalits? No. Many of us enter movements through the organizations we work in. As feminist activist Srilata Bhatliwala reminds us, organizations are sites from which movements are built and supported. But organizations, even though they are part of movements, are not in themselves movements. Movements operate at a scale that no single organization can operate at. Since so many of us belong to NGOs, Here is a question for each of us. How do we locate ourselves? Do we see ourselves as part of an organization, or do we see ourselves as part of a movement, or as parts of both? This is an important question because it relates to what we see as our final goal. Are we working on sexual harassment or domestic violence or access to land and water or whatever we do as an end in itself? Or is it both an end in itself and a means to transform power relations between men and women? Is it enough for us to cite water resources near a low-income community and increase access to water, or do we also question who is responsible for collecting that water? And why is that the case? And what can we do about that? Is it enough for us to ensure that land is redistributed to a landless family? Or do we stop and wonder why that land cannot be placed in a woman's name? Is it enough for us to ensure that a woman has a job? Or do we ask ourselves why she can't decide how to spend the money she earns, or why she couldn't get the job in the first place? And how can we change all that? All of us work to change things, but the question really is, how far do we push change? Up to what level? Many of our organizations provide services, valuable services, to our constituents, but do we see these services as ends in themselves, or do we see them as both ends and as means to actualize rights? In our own NGOs, do we see ourselves as doing the work of movements, getting to the roots to create radical fundamental change? Or do we see ourselves tinkering with the symptoms without pushing through to the roots? Many activists feel that NGOization is an internal challenge to the process of building movements. Another challenge, this time external, is fundamentalism of all kinds, whether it is the fundamentalisms of the market, which take away the sovereignty of the nation states we live in, that of religious forces who try to recreate medieval forms of womanhood, or sexual fundamentalism, which day in and day out pushes heterosexuality down our throats. This is something that erodes the power of movements, and yet, this is something we can only tackle in movements, not as organizations standing alone. As movements working together, we can do this. To go back to the dismantling of apartheid in South Africa, this was not the work of one movement alone, but movements working hand in hand. An emerging challenge to movements is philanthrocapitalism, or the belief that business principles can be applied to the search for social transformation. Philanthrocapitalist donors, and we know who they are, have money and are prepared to put it into social change, but they are impatient for solutions, data, and results. And they believe that change can happen like that, instantly, in a jiffy. Everything we know tells us what creates lasting change is the slow, lasting power of movements, but that creating this change takes generations. My grandmother got married when she was 16 and never worked for a living. My mother got married when she was 24 and worked for a living till she got married. Marriage is not on my agenda, and I can't imagine a situation where my livelihood depends on not on my own two hands, but on someone else's. A century ago, who would have thought that women would vote? Something we take for granted in some places today. That's the power of movements. Or even that women are human, that's the power of movements. Half a century ago, when slavery had ended, but segregation was in place, who would have thought that the next president of the United States of America would be an African-American man? That's the power of movements. The power to use the power we have. The power to use the power.